Men, if you've lost your hair, it doesn't mean you can't find it again. Try Hims Hair Loss Solutions and you'll be joining hundreds of thousands of subscribers who found their hair again. It can be hard for men to deal with hair loss, even though it is common. Luckily, I'm here to provide you with a solution so you don't even have to talk about it. Through Hims, you can restore your hair by accessing their personalized hair loss solutions. Men value many different things about their appearance. But if you're a guy who really cares about your hair and find that it's slowly going away, you might be feeling discouraged when you look in the mirror. And that's where Hims comes in. Check out their personalized hair loss solutions, and you can start seeing your hair grow back in as little as 3 to 6 months. Hims provides you with convenient access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple with doctor-trusted options and clinically proven ingredients, like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. Choose from personalized chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatments to find what works best for you. The process is simple and 100% online, so there are no uncomfortable doctor visits. Answer a few questions, and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to you for free. No insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, and they can help you get your confidence back too with visibly thicker and fuller hair. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/Hail Mary. Results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you, most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're back for part two of the defense against the Eagles in preseason game one. And joining me again is Jonas Schaefer. Jonas, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Good, Ken. How are you doing?
Loving talking football. We just had some good news on the Orioles come through while we're recording here. So they won their game 7-5, which you probably know by now if you're listening to this and care to know. Nice to beat Tampa a couple in a row, get back on their winning ways. Now we're going to talk about the Ravens and individually how they performed in this game on defense against the Eagles in the first preseason game. If you missed the first episode, please go back and take a listen. Some excellent points, some great discussion over the deployment order, some of the challenges the Ravens had with a very undermanned defensive front in terms of how they gave up a very successful rushing game without allowing very much in the way of obvious rushing statistical success. 3.8 yards per carry, long run of 9. You think that's a game you can win, but the Eagles actually ran the ball very well. All that's in the first episode. This episode, we're going to talk about individual players. Jonas, you're the guest. Why don't you start us off with a player you'd like to talk about?
Let's go with... I guess Josh Ross. I think I probably had the most notes on him, and frankly, a lot of them are bad. We talked in some detail in the first episode about the touchdown that was falsely attributed to Nate Wiggins' coverage when in fact it was, you know, Josh Ross was screened. And then the next note I have for him was the sack for 0 yards, I think, in that first or second quarter. But then, you know, I have a note on him basically getting bamboozled on an RPO where he goes back to prevent the in-breaking route, like the kind of glance route or whatever it would have been, before he saw whether the Eagles quarterback McKee had even handed it off. And so he kind of does like a U-turn and then another U-turn, and it ends up being an Eagles 5 yard gain. He's demolished by a puller on a third quarter run that led to another good run for the Eagles. And then he had a chance to stop Lou Nichols in the gap on that third quarter touchdown, but just, you know, whiffed in tight space. So I think it's been a pretty disappointing camp for Josh Ross. It's always tough to evaluate these inside linebackers in camp, because unless you're just getting dunked on by tight ends, or, you know, getting run by running backs on wheel routes, you are pretty much anonymous. But I think it's been a little bit disappointing for him, and I don't think that this preseason game is going to help his stock at all when it comes to, you know, potentially being a guy who could maybe sneak onto the back end of this roster.
Well, I'd have to agree with a lot of that. I mean, he certainly played a lot of snaps, 55 snaps in this game. He played for basically the first three quarters of the game, mostly with Simpson. Incredible that they would use Simpson that much in this game, but they did. I thought he had a mixed bag of notes versus the run. I thought mixed was actually better than some of the rest of the front seven. But I will say I had him for four notes where he was blocked or caught in the wash near the point of attack on Philly run wins. And there were so many of those in this game. I just said, I'm not laying out five notes for everybody on this particular type of thing. And there were some players who had you know, a really bad night for it. But Ross was a guy who had, he did have some good plays as well. But you mentioned the one, it was a bad one, but I think it was more a good play for Grant Calcaterra, the tight end, to set a pick on Ross on Shipley's touchdown than it was really a bad play for Ross. Ross was a little late. That was his primary crime on that play. But otherwise he, you know, I thought he played okay. He was picked up on the blitz a couple times. One of the times he was picked up on the blitz was the time we talked earlier that he almost was the sacrificial inside rusher when Pepe got his 10-yard sack. So that was a good one as well. And then he had it's essentially a sack. It was a run for one by Pickett. That it's a world of difference between a 0 yard sack, which goes in your sack column and changes a whole bunch of things about the way you look at things and, you know, yards per pass play that the other team is getting and whatnot, or however you want to look at it. And a 1 yard run, but essentially that's just a sack plus one. He gave up on that, or he scored on that one. I had him as a zero grade for the game. What that means for me is that it didn't change. Nothing about this game really changed my opinion on where Ross sits in the depth chart. I think the fact that they played him for as many snaps as they did and they didn't pull him early might have been probably a good sign for him, if anything, that they didn't get Rigby in there a little bit earlier. Look at him.
Right.
Didn't get Jennings in with him as being a competitor. I actually think he doesn't have a lot of competition right now for the fourth inside linebacker spot. If you're going to do it, it'd be some combination of Malik being a guy that they were committing to using on the inside, and then them also keeping Board and who am I forgetting? Board, Simpson, Roquan, and no, that's all they got. I'm not missing anybody.
Yeah.
So if Malik is their fourth inside linebacker, then they can still say goodbye to Josh Rosh. If he's not, then they can't.
Right. Yeah. I feel like that they know what they have in Malik, and that versatility would probably go a long way in keeping someone that they feel like could contribute more meaningfully than Josh Rosh this season. But, you know, we've still got two preseason games to go. I don't want to write him off prematurely.
Right. I'll pick another inside linebacker and we'll just stay in the same position group when we can here. Rigby had an interesting game. Now, you look at the stat sheet, he had seven tackles and he only played 21 snaps. So you think, damn, this guy, you know, is really getting it done in terms of getting the ball. And he did prevent some long plays. But if you looked at his seven tackles, only one was a defensive win. All the other six were success binary successes for the offense. And the one defensive win was on the very last play of the game where they were centering up for a field goal with a quarterback sneak. So not really the kind of, you know, defensive success you want from your inside linebacker. And he's, we talked about this in the first show, but he's missed a lot of training camp already. I counted about eight consecutive practices to miss the preseason that he missed before he came back. Didn't even really expect for sure that he'd be playing in this game, but he you know, back, played a, you know, not insignificant share of the total. I do think he's still a candidate to be on the practice squad because of the fact that he's got the size that I think they would crave if anything happened to Roquan.
Yeah, I think he was one of the darling names of that undrafted free agent list, but it's not just camp, Ken, that he's been dealing with injuries. It was, I think, also a little bit of mini camp, or maybe all of mini camp, where he was MIA. So, you know, you don't want to write him off or anything, but obviously you can't make the club in the tub. And he's had some soft tissue injuries that have gotten in the way of him standing out. Obviously, the Ravens probably would have liked to have had him get a couple more practice reps underneath underneath his belt before throwing him out there to the degree that they did. But you know, as we've kind of talked about in the first pod, they didn't have a whole lot of options in terms of depth. And at a certain point, you know, these guys are signed to play pro football, so you got to, you know, if you're capable and ready, then you got to line up and play some pro football.
Yeah, I think it's your turn again.
I forget. Do we want to save like the MVP types for the MVP section? Do we just kind of?
You can talk about them now, and you don't have to give it away, or you can give it away. I don't really care if you.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I think there were some interesting performances that I would be interested in talking about. I thought not a overwhelming performance by Travis Jones. I just am still very impressed by just how strong he is and how impossible it is to block him one-on-one. There were a couple times where, you know, he did get shoved a little bit out of the club when, you know, the Eagles hit those combination blocks where he's double teamed and, you know, bumped over a gap or half a gap. And, you know, obviously that's something that he's got to improve on if he wants to overtake Mike Pierce as, you know, the top nose tackle on this team. But there was one play, I think, where he, you know, kind of just worked his way through a guard or a center on a pass rush rep like it was nothing. Like he was just, you know, a high school, you know, lineman trying to block him. And I believe he had said, I wasn't there for this press conference, but I think he said that one of the moves that he's trying to work on in camp is the, you know, Reggie White hump move, where you just kind of, it's maybe you can do a better job explaining it than I can, Ken, but you just kind of, you know, use your momentum to throw off a guy essentially, and have a very, very direct path to the quarterback. And you have to be a very, very special brand of strong and technically sound, and I think speedy as well, to kind of throw off a guy who's blocking for you like that. But there was a third and long where it seemed like he tried it and it kind of sort of worked, and he was able to either get close or get an actual pressure. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. That's new. Obviously, the Eagles, I think, really only threw out one starter in that game, Tyler Steen. So this is, you know, not a representative level of quality that he'll be going up against when the bullets start flying in week one. But I'm always just delighted to see him be a bully, because that was, I think, what stood out. Was it last year or 2 years ago where he had that preseason game on the road where he just kind of took over for a series and was basically unblockable?
Last year, he was unbelievable in the first preseason game, also against the Eagles. And it's pretty. Okay. I think it's pretty high quality stuff. I mean, you look at the way the Eagles pushed the Ravens around in this game on the ground, and then they won the battle up front like nobody's business. As we don't need to rehash that whole thing. I'll just say two things about this. One is, I don't grade guys who aren't on the fringe of the roster. So a player like Jones, fantastic that he played, great that he played well, doesn't mean a damn thing to me in terms of you know, right, judging the fringe of the roster. So I'm not going to have more to say about him specifically than that. Other than to say, the last time he's at the podium corroborated some things I've heard about him from Brent Urban. I can just say he is, we see big guys at the podium almost every day. We've seen Michael Pierce there this year, and he's a big guy and a big round guy. And we've seen Brent Urban there, who is a tall and very thick guy as well. In fact, I think it was the defensive line coach. I think it was Weaver who used to say, the two of you together are a perfect 10. And you guys can figure out who the one and the zero are. It was a really mean thing to say, but Melissa Kim was the one who told me about that. I thought it was a great line.
Yeah, she told me that as well.
but the other thing that Urban said, which is really, this is unique to Travis Jones, is that when he stunts, you know, you want to basically hit the shoulder of a guy who's a gap and a half over, if you want to think of it that way, because you're in between a gap. You cross the face of a lineman, then you hit a lineman who you might be crossing the face of a center and hitting the shoulder of the guard, and you want to throw the play completely off and set a pick, or even you just set yourself up for a good underneath move. He always has to go into that contact with two arms. He said the one guy I've seen who can go into it with one arm is Travis Jones. The only guy I've seen do that. And like Michael Pierce doesn't do that. And you think, I mean, that is very, very high praise for a guy who, you know, has made a lot of his living off leverage with his arms like that. So I thought that was impressive. Travis Jones, very clearly the guy who's going to be running with Matabike on the passing downs this year. I'm excited as hell to see it.
Yeah. Yeah. This wasn't a first string rep, but you know, I had been wondering with the emergence of Travis Jones in camp. And, you know, I think like Cliff Brown of the Ravens.com in one of his stories, you know, had said that Travis Jones was like the best player in camp. And I thought like that was pushing a little bit too far, but you know, I have thought a little bit about what him being a potential factor on obvious passing situations could mean for the pass rush. Like, because, you know, he could be a pocket pusher, but I couldn't really remember a whole lot of like tackle stunts for the Ravens last year. But there was, I believe, a play last night. Maybe it was like, you know, with Sanat or Walthour or one of the guys inside, where it is a tackle stunt, and it wasn't executed super well, but it did kind of give me the idea of, you know, could we see Travis Jones, you know, lined up as the as the one tech or the nose tech on, you know, the weak side or the strong side. And then obviously you have Matabike on the other side as a three tech. And, you know, Travis Jones is just kind of throwing himself across the line of scrimmage diagonally, and then having Matabike be the looper, and just, you know, getting that half body position on whoever is trying to pick him up, you know, from that mess. Could that be something that we see from the Ravens this year? Because, you know, I think Michael Pierce was a pretty good pass rusher last year, especially over the first half of the season. But it seemed to me, from my recollection, was just a lot of him, you know, trying to bowl people over. And I wonder if we will see maybe some more creativity with Travis Jones. I think he's you know, doesn't have the kind of dancing bear feet that maybe would make something like that easier to execute. But the fact that the Ravens tried a tackle stunt did lead me to believe that maybe we could see some more creativity there on the inside, as a potential changeup for, you know, how the Ravens want to approach their pass rush this year.
It is much more common to see tackle and stunts, and, you know, people even they have their own classification as TE stunts, but I'll say TE twists. But you know, the one of the reasons why you're more likely to see a tackle and stunt is because the ends are your quicker over guys. Exactly. And you're limited usually in terms of the under guys and who could be really successful. And those guys are some of the highest paid best players in the entire NFL. You know, the guys highly sought after to get interior pass rushers. And oftentimes, you know, what that guy will do for you is the underneath player often gets the better opportunity out of it, but he needs to have a good exploiter, and the end exploiting it can actually set up the under guy better, because it really forces a very quick reaction from that half man player to leave a Travis Jones, for example, or an Aaron Donald, or any number of other interior defensive, great defensive pass rushers you can name, free to get off that half man. Tim Jernigan in Ravens history is a great one. Pernell McPhee, a great one in terms of beating those kind of making those kind of underneath moves and making them pay once a player got peeled off.
there was always I think one of the things that has stuck with me from watching Derek Wolf tape, and that's probably a name mm-hmm. that you didn't expect me to bring up on that tape.
That's
was
a good one.
Was just how incredible his synergy was with Von Miller in Denver on those end tackle stunts, and they were so good at you know, basically always giving themselves a chance to get a pressure. And I'm sure a lot of, you know, Derek Wolf can probably owe a good deal of his bank account to Von Miller because those guys work so well together, and Von Miller's quickness and his strength and, you know, unselfishness, I guess, as well, really helped, you know, Derek Wolf become that guy who was able to get, like, you know, 5, 6, 7 sack seasons.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me move on to another player here. I will go with Josh Tapu. Do I have that correct? It's Tapu. 53 snaps gives you an idea of just how significantly he was stretched. I'm going to send you to my article to look at all the notes I have on the guy, but really had an exceptional night. I believe he drew a holding call that may have been Sanat, pancaked the right guard Hennessy a couple of times, really had his way with him on a three-play series over the course of about 12 seconds in the fourth quarter. He was tremendously successful in terms of getting some push, was one of the better players in playing the run. In fact, I don't have a bunch of really big negative notes for him on the run plays. He's doubled a lot, there are some of those for sure, but it's not like some of the other guys who are getting beaten by a tight end or blocked by somebody one-on-one a lot of times. So anyway, a fine night for him. Did have a lot of frustrating double teams. You know, he's one of the guys, though, the Eagles had to use two bodies on. They were pretty successful at it, but I thought his success in the pass game, and also had some nice moves. A little corkscrew move he went to, if you want to look at Q4 327 specifically, goes to one knee. Now, normally that's a move you try when you're getting double teamed. You go to one knee, you reduce your surface area on your shoulder facing the second lineman, and you force them to give up and climb, basically, because they think that the other lineman has it. Then you get right up off that knee. Did it to Hennessy directly, and looked very good to stop Milton. Came right off him for a stop for a 1 yard gain. So, it was a big night for him. I thought, you know, he doesn't necessarily fit into the Ravens' plans at all. Being a 30-year-old outside of the Big Five, he may or may not actually last on the Ravens' practice squad for even a week or two if he goes there. The NFL is short on defensive linemen. They'll look for big bodies. And a guy who's had some good tape now in camp or in, you know, for the preseason is going to be one of the guys that teams look for.
Yeah. I didn't have nowhere near as many notes as you can. I had good work versus a double team on a third quarter run. And then a big bull rush to get a pressure and I guess draw a sack to start the fourth quarter. So, good work for him. Obviously, the Ravens definitely needed some help up the middle after that shaky first half, and I think he really stabilized things, especially after halftime.
Okay. All right. Who's your next guy?
Let's go with. I guess we can talk about not a guy who's in any jeopardy of. Being on the outs of this roster, but Brody had an interesting game. He had a good push on the first drive that led to an incompletion as a pass rusher. I think on the next run play, so maybe one play later, two plays later, he got kind of caved in on a double team and just completely worked on an inside run. On another play in the second quarter, he gets a little bit too far upfield and gets kind of ushered out of his gap. That leads to a nice Eagles run, but then he showed a nice rip move against the right guard to force Pickett to leave the pocket in the second quarter. So I know that, you know, the pass rush arsenal has been a focus of his. I think we have seen that show some dividends in, especially in minicamp, early part of training camp. I know that's obviously a focus of his, considering we haven't really seen a whole lot of sacks for him. I think it's probably no more than one or two over this his first few seasons each season. But it was a little bit hit or miss in terms of his contributions to the run game, and maybe him being a little bit over eager and perhaps a little bit overconfident against some of these second and third string Eagles linemen, that he would be able to handle them just by virtue of being a guy who, you know, is a established veteran in this league and, you know, maybe just got a little bit over skis on some of these run plays.
I definitely have him for a number of notes, like a lot of these front seven guys, in terms of really front six guys, honestly, in terms of being blocked on run plays. He's not a guy, of course, that I would grade because his roster spot, I don't believe, is in any jeopardy. Didn't have the greatest year last year. So, you know, you could come up with a reason why he might not be the ideal guy having your roster. And then you look at the money and you say, there's no way, because the Ravens to cut him would have to accelerate cap. So that ain't happening. But he's, you know, he's a player that the Ravens really need to work out. They need to get quality snaps out of him because he's going to have roughly a sixth, maybe, of their total defensive line snaps for the year if he stays healthy. He'll be a little bit less than an average guy in terms of the percentage of snaps he takes, but it will be important, and he'll be on the field a lot. He has to play good complementary football. If they start getting behind in games at any point this year, like they really were not last year, he becomes more significant because you've got to get more base defense snaps out of your crew of five. And you definitely have to start spreading it to more players when you do that. So Broderick is a guy I think that the Ravens need to get something out of. I remember, because you were the one who told me he'd been signed. I learned the news late, as often happens, that he'd been signed that day. And I remember how excited I was because he was really the first, other than after Travis Jones, to be brought back for the 2024 season. And then it turns out they managed to get the entire gang back together.
Right. Yeah. My memory was that his season had turned around a little bit after that benching in week 11 against the Bengals, where he was a healthy scratch. And you know, maybe your grades will disagree, but it looks like it's still a pretty steady rollout of like below 60 grades on PFF for the overall defensive grade. So I don't know if I was just having the more romantic version of how he finished last year, but the PFF grades do not support, you know, a kind of turning of the corner. But he's always going to be a guy who's just, you know, obsessed with working out, obsessed with trying to give himself edges. Obviously, he's, you know, a guy who was a fifth round selection. I don't think anyone probably, you know, realistically expected him to be the kind of presence that he was in 2022 when I thought he had a really, really nice season. But you know, the Ravens, like you said, they need him to get back to, you know, above water, because that they can't have him be, you know, a guy who's liable to get washed out on these double teams and all this stuff, especially considering, you know, some of the teams that have given him trouble, like the Steelers. I always think about, you know, him being at his lowest moment in that game against the Steelers in 2022, when the Ravens just could not stop that Pittsburgh run game, and he was just completely distraught in the locker room afterward.
I will say one thing about the PFF grades on the interior defensive line in particular. PFF has changed their standard for missed tackles. If you go in there and you order all of the players on all defensive linemen in terms of missed tackle rates or tackling grades, that's probably the better one to do it. You're going to see a whole bunch of red and orange and almost nobody who's in the green among the entire group of interior defensive linemen, very small group. That actually makes it into, you know, a grade well over 60 in that area. And it's because their tackling standard has become tougher, and they still have a trailing tackling standard where they're looking back at a time when they did it differently, and they're grading it against that. So they're awarding more missed tackles now. And now we look back at a period where they had less missed tackles, and they go, well, this guy sucks. Now, 2023 must be a terrible tackling year because everybody sucks, kind of thing. Well, no, it's just you change your standard, and that makes it more difficult for them to do things. They'll build into that, and I've seen other things come up with this with various PFF statistics before. When they change their standard, they end up with an entire position group looking bad simultaneously. So you got to look at it kind of relatively, and it may be that last year, you know, a 52 tackling grade wouldn't be that bad. You know, it'd be kind of normal. But they changed their standard, and you know, it is what it is. I, by the way, PFF is fantastic in terms of what have they given us in terms of relativity. I think it's just that, you know, being a conscientious consumer of that information is probably pretty important as you go into it. Question things, ask questions. PFF is very happy to answer those, and every team has a PFF guy who is like a liaison to the fan base, who will basically answer those questions for you. So they're very open about their methodology too, which is something I've always appreciated about the group.
Yeah, all right. And some guys, I mean, I think fans will take for granted that a, you know, player's PFF score is a reflection of their ability and their responsibilities. And, you know, I think people look at Marlon Humphrey having, I don't have his grade in front of me, but I imagine last year is probably in the low 60s. And then, you know, to me, that didn't really match up with what I had remembered watching. And so I did a, you know, big story, big analysis on the EVA training camp, just kind of looking at his 2023. And I came away a lot more impressed. He did not look like a low 60s guy on PFF, but obviously, you know, how they weight certain things, how they measure certain things, it's understandable why he would have been, you know, underperforming, I guess, in certain respects. But I think it's important to have podcasts like this and, you know, all the outlets on, you know, Ravens YouTube and Ravens Twitter to actually, you know, point out this player is actually doing well despite what, you know, the PFF grade might say, or this player is actually doing poorly despite what the PFF grade might say. And I think for me, that was kind of crystallized in the case of Marlon Humphrey, because I was really, really impressed with what he did last year. And to me, he didn't look like a mediocre player, which I think is what the PFF score suggested.
Well, you know, it's great to see Marlon Humphrey in camp this year, because you mentioned, I think you mentioned that Cliff said that Travis Jones is the best player in camp. There's no doubt in my mind Marlon Humphrey has stood head and shoulders above every player in camp. I mean, he's been outrageously good. Either side of the ball.
I agree. I think he was my top player for the first week of camp, and he probably would have been, you know, my colleague Gianna Hahn's top player as well for the second week if we did repeat names. He's just been, you know, when he has been targeted, he's made plays on the ball. He's gotten picks, and but those plays are fewer and further between, because I think quarterbacks, especially Lamar, have basically given up throwing his direction, because he's been locked down. I think for so much of camp.
Well, it's a good thing that, you know, they can go into 2025, I hope, with a healthy Humphrey and a more clear decision about what they have on the roster and how they can move forward, whether that means Wiggins is a good player or where he is in his developmental track. And it'll give them an idea of whether or not they really feel like they can sign Stevens or have to during the year at some point to an extension to try and keep him around.
Right, sure.
But either way, they have decisions to make at corner.
Yeah, I think probably the thing, we shouldn't make this the Marlon Humphrey podcast, but I think probably the most important takeaway from me, not just the, you know, productivity, but the interceptions, and obviously some of that has been Lamar missing, some of that has been Josh Johnson missing. You don't want to make too big a deal about it, but I think just the foot speed that we've seen with him, you know, running down the sideline with these quite fast group of Ravens wide receivers has been really heartening. You know, I know, you know, folks like Mike Preston have been pretty outspoken for a couple of years now about how, you know, he doesn't think that Marlon has the speed to make it as an outside cornerback in the league anymore. And, you know, I can certainly see why that viewpoint would have been, you know, proffered, but I feel like the way that he's been able to run in this camp with the lighter weight on his frame, it really supports to me the notion that he could play just about anywhere in this defense and be really, really successful.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, we could be seeing a time, maybe as early as 2024, where Humphrey and Hamilton could literally switch positions on a down by down basis. Now, the Ravens really want Humphrey for outside corner, but if you ever had a year where you had, you know, more than you needed at outside corner, and you wanted to make sure that you maintain Hamilton's flexibility to back or front, Humphrey has shown so much more in this camp. Speed, I'm all for it. Physicality, I want to see it continue, but it's not the 9.5 value of his game. The thing that has been remarkable in his game has been finding the football this year is at a higher level than ever has been before. You know, he's finding the football in the air. All right. So I don't remember whose turn it is here. Who put the last player and we talked about, and let's move on here. We got another.
Was it Travis Jones or was Brody? I put Brody for.
You said Brody. I said Tepo before that. So I'll go with another lineman here. I want to talk about CJ Ravenel, because I thought he's been impressive. Played you know, he's basically a five tech. He's a 6'5", 292 guy. He's really built in the mold more of a Brent Urban in terms of not quite as big, or a Zach Sealer maybe in terms of his approximate height and weight. He's a rookie. Walther is a rookie. And to put this in the perspective, Sanat and Tupou are both older players, sixth and seventh year respectively, I believe. And, you know, the Ravens obviously are highly incented if they can find a gem between either Ravenel or Walther to be their guy. Ravenel is the guy who really played well in this game, in my opinion. They played him on the outside. They played him as effectively as an uncovered end in this game. And he had a lot of positive notes in my game. I won't bore you by going through all of them, but he also had less times where he was blocked effectively on plays. There were some, I'm not saying there were none, but he did a great job. He shared a sack with Walther at one point. And what else did he do? He contained Pickett on a designed RL1. Again, that almost is as good as a sack there. He billed Toth for a pressure. That's the center to force a punt. So he's in there on some drive ending plays. He had a quarterback hit by beating Kennard that was negated by that illegal contact penalty on Matthew, which was, that was probably the play that lost the Ravens the game, frankly, but it certainly wasn't his fault. And he did miss a tackle in the backfield, but like I said before, there's missed tackles and missed tackles. Bo Braid cleaned it up for RL minus one with one of the most scary looking undercuts I've ever seen of another player.
Oh yeah.
Late in that game. So Ravenel, a great game. And he's a really interesting guy, probably a top of the practice squad guy, but I think he could really help the Ravens. I hope they can keep him.
Yeah. I just ventured over to his Twitter page, and I don't know if Missouri Western football had a
watch party,
a watch party or whatever, but I retweeted it on my Twitter feed, but it looked like they had the entire team watching the game, and after the sack that he had to close up the first half, they, you know, the social media guy for Missouri Western football whipped out the camera and filmed everyone hooting and hollering to celebrate that sack. So he's got a nice support system. But yeah, like we talked about him during the first podcast about just the strength profile and size, and you know, John Harbaugh's been impressed by him, and you know, obviously not tremendous production coming out of college. I think it was like three sacks or something. Mm-hmm. But you know, 6'5". 295 ish. I think you can definitely do a lot of things with him in terms of where you want to line him up. And he's definitely, you know, when matched up against some of the some of the weaker in terms of physical strength tight ends and wide receivers inside who've had to block him, I think he's definitely, you know, put them through hell, because he is a very imposing guy, and you know, hasn't always translated to productivity as a pass rusher in training camp, but I think against the run he's been pretty stout.
Yeah. All right, your turn. Who do you got?
I guess we can talk about Bo Braid, since you just brought him up. Mm-hmm. You know, we haven't really had a occasion to talk about him a lot during OTAs or mini camp or training camp. I think he's made a little bit more waves recently, but this is probably his best performance as a Raven. You know, he obviously almost kind of scooped that fumble back onto the field of play on the punt coverage. He had a nice hit coming in from the safety depth in the fourth quarter. He did have a missed tackle that I think I mentioned earlier that ended up not being hugely consequential, but it would have been, you know, a nice 1 or 2 or 3 yard gain that ended up getting extended by a couple more yards. And then he came back a few plays later, and I think he got that, I believe it was a tackle for a loss or maybe just a 0 yard play where he, you know, takes advantage of the running back who's, you know, kind of on, you know, on thin ice in terms of like how he's walking because he's just broken free from that tackle. I guess it was Ravenel. I think Ken, you said, and he just kind of undercuts him and just kind of decleats him. So he was a heat seeking missile in a way that was encouraging to me to, you know, see a guy who was playing, you know, with the kind of clarity that he wasn't really having a whole lot of hesitation about where he wanted to go. I still think obviously he's a, you know, a huge, huge dark horse to make this roster. And I think the Ravens would probably be happy to stash him on the practice squad and maybe develop him into a potential, you know, box safety. Cause I just don't know if he has the foot speed. I think it was like a 4.62 guy in the 40, to be a, you know, even a split field safety kind of guy. But, you know, it was good to see him do his thing, especially with like the entire Maryland football team there, kind of rooting him on.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. I kind of forgotten that they had the interview with Loxley on the side there, but that was a great moment. One thing that often gets lost when you're talking about players and the kind of game they've had is what penalties they've drawn. He actually drew a holding call on the left guard, Gates. Gates was actually pulling further to the left, caught Braid on the outside, for some reason decided to tackle him and was flagged for holding on a play and negated what would have been their longest run of the day. They had a 13-yard run on that play. That came back for holding. When the other team is gaining 4 yards every single play, one of the really nice ways that the defense can get off the field is just get a holding call in there. And, otherwise, it's very hard to stop a highly efficient machine like the Eagles were against the Ravens in this game. But the holding calls really helped out the several times they occurred. I'm in agreement with you. I don't think it's going to be easy for him to make the roster. I think he's a practice squad guy, and I would probably agree that he's a box safety. Now, it's very difficult to develop instincts at the NFL level for the first time. I'm not saying it never happens, but I think it's much more likely to happen with a corner converted to safety than a mediocre, hard-hitting college strong safety turning into a good back-end safety in the NFL. I'd say that's much more rare. I'm not confident in that either, but Braid is a guy like Sanusi Kane who could help the team on special teams, who could be a hitter and a dime possibility. I find one thing with safeties is a lot of their coverage skills are very portable. So when they move up and they're playing the first line of quarters defense or the first line of cover three, they're much better at understanding what that play looks like behind them than most inside linebackers are, for example.
Yeah, that's a good point.
All right, let me move on here because we got to go a little quicker. I want to get to one guy who we haven't talked about yet, who's a front seven guy, and that's Joe Evans. So Joe Evans, some people know his story and some people don't. Went to Iowa, fifth in. Didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100%. Federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious high-potency gummies, top-shelf flower, home-baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary, you can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Big Ten history in sacks. That's the big line on Joe Evans. Comes to the NFL with extremely short arms for an edge rusher in particular. He's small in general. He's about 252, which is a little bit on the small side. You could get by with that if you're built like Za'Darius Smith is, say. But he's not. And he's not a long guy. He's a 30 and change inch arms guy, which puts him right in there with the shortest arm defensive tackles you'll ever find on an NFL field. He had a lot of trouble in this particular game. And I don't like to beat on players too much, but I will say this. I had 7 notes, which was about the most of plays where he was recorded on a blocked play near the point of attack. The Eagles are actually running at him at his side a lot. And one of the things that kept happening on five of those seven plays was that he was blocked by the tight end one-on-one. That's a big no-no, and it's a big length concern for Evans. So it's something that, you know, as an outside linebacker, he's got to find a way to clean that up. Hand fighting, violence of his hands is probably the only way he gets that done. The things he did in college at Iowa that got him the gaudy sack total he had, he's going to have to do more at the NFL level and take his hand fighting to a different level in order to be successful there. But anyway, very long outing for him. The Ravens, I think, are grateful for the fact that he could take that many snaps in a game like this where they're very shorthanded. That said, I don't really think he improved his chance on making the roster here, which would have been a dark horse situation anyway. Practice squad, I guess he's still a possibility, probably still kind of an outside shot.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you want to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that some of the bad reps that I have down him, that I have noted down here for him, were potentially just him kind of sucking wind and not being ready to go for, you know, the 60 plus snaps that he did. You know, it would have been nice to have him in a bit more of a rotation, but, you know, like you said, that there was a play where he lost the edge in the third quarter, went for about 7 yards. And then I think probably the most egregious example of him not being able to kind of anchor and hold the point of attack was, I believe, he just kind of gets washed out. And I think, in fact, pancaked by a tight end on that outside shotgun handoff in the fourth quarter that went for another really nice gain. So, you know, he did have a pressure that I think he, you know, got to Pickett at about the same time that Brent Urban in that second quarter, where he, you know, I think it was just a speed rush off of the right tackle and kind of dipped his shoulder, was able to, you know, bend the edge pretty well. And that was impressive. And I think he stood out more to other people in training camp than he has to me. You know, I tend to not focus as intently on, you know, some of the third string action when that gets going. But I think he has made some waves with the people who are, you know, keeping track of just how the third string defensive line is doing, how the third string outside linebackers are doing. But this is not a game that is probably going on his highlight reel as his agent makes his case for the 53 for the practice squad.
Right. There you go. You're up.
I guess we can talk about Tavius Robinson. I didn't have a whole lot of notes on him. I did kind of come away from this game, you know, thinking or wondering maybe if his best use in pass rushing downs is not as an outside, as a edge rusher, but as the classic, you know, line up a big, strong outside linebacker over the three tech and just see if he can knock back the guard or have that quickness advantage over the guard and you know, out leverage him that way. There was a kind of ugly speed rush that he had in this game where he just gets washed way too far upfield. And just like, what are you doing, Tavius? Like, you should know that, you know, your best chance is kind of working speed to power or maybe just, you know, working inside. You know, he had an athletic club move to win on a run play against the left tackle in the first quarter that stood out to me. You know, I still think he looks good moving in space. You know, it's always, I think, a bit of a surprise to people to go back and look at his combine test and then realize he was a sub 4.7 guy in the 40. Cause you know, you think of him more as a kind of plodding presence, but I think an overall solid game for him. Obviously his roster spot is not in any doubt just because of the state of that outside linebacker group in general. And I still think he could be a guy who gets a couple sacks this year, maybe a couple more than that. But I just am kind of curious what the, you know, what Chuck Smith and what Zach Orr feel like his optimal position will be in obvious passing downs, if there is a role for him to have in those spots.
Right. I guess I could ask it as a question, or I could just state it in the interest of time. I'm just going to state it. I don't think there's a place for a rush nickel with having three good interior defensive line pass rushers. The Ravens are in, they've got a horn of plenty, a embarrassment of riches in terms of what they have in terms of interior pass rush. I don't think they're looking to create that. Even if Isaac works out, and even if you know Ajabo comes back and he's playing well, and they have Van Noy and they have Owe, I mean, they may find a way to get a third guy on the field, but you know, they've got their three interior guys are too damn good, and they bring too much to the table in terms of different body types and how they can use them in the pass rush, I think, for them to take them off the field. So I think they'll find a way to have two of those three, and we'll see actually very little rush nickel this year, would be my prediction, barring injury. Of course, if injury occurs, that's all off the table, and we could see just about anything if that were to happen.
Right. Yeah, that's totally fair.
All right. I'll do one more just because I want to talk about one defensive back at least. How about Bump Cooper, who I thought had a very fine game in this one. He's one of the guys I looked at, but had a pressure where he forced McKee to roll right, threw the ball out of bounds. He had tight coverage of Harris in the end zone on the big play, knocked it away cleanly. The ball was out of there so quickly. I was like, did he catch it? You know, because I didn't see the ball, you know, from my seat anyway. I didn't see the ball go away from the receiver, but he slapped it away pretty hard. A bunch of other good plays where he was there in coverage. The ball, he didn't have to tip the ball because the ball was overthrown by means of his presence. He had step for step coverage of Harris, for example, with about 4 minutes left in the game. That it was close to the right sideline. It was only a few yards past the line of scrimmage, but the ball was overthrown because of that. And just a very fine game for a player who's, I think, had a solid camp. I don't think he's received a lot of attention because of, you know, largely playing with the threes. But he's a guy I think who could fit certainly on the practice squad for the Ravens.
Great nickname too. I was shocked that not until the NFL did he adopt the nickname Bump, because you look at every mention of him at Oregon State, it is Ryan. Ryan Cooper Jr. So maybe there's another Ryan Cooper in the NFL that he wanted to distinguish himself from, past or present. But I love Bump as a nickname, and it's definitely appropriate for cornerback.
Yeah, it's a cool one. Anybody else you want to talk about?
I think I'm flushed out.
Okay.
Besides the guys that, you know, we can save for the MVP discussion.
Well, let's go to that right now. The MVPs of the game. Now, normally we wouldn't do this because, hey, a loss, you shouldn't be celebrating who the MVP was, but in the preseason, it's actually kind of important because your top players, you know, have their lives on the line in terms of their professional careers on the line anyway, in terms of play. So start off with your number three guy. Who is it?
I think my number three guy was Trenton Simpson. I think all of the on-field production speaks for itself. The 11 tackles, I think five of them were solo tackles. Then you throw in the element of him handling the green dot, which is a, you know, huge imposition on itself. I don't know if he even had those responsibilities at Clemson, but I think it definitely can be edifying for a player to have that perspective and see what Roquan sees when he is entrusted with that responsibility, and, you know, probably emphasizes to a guy like Trent Simpson, who has been very, you know, loquacious with us whenever he talks to us, and does not strike me as a guy who is, you have to kind of, you know, bring out of his shell and encourage to communicate more. But I think probably putting a guy in a spot like that definitely reinforces just how important it is to not be afraid to, you know, yell at a guy that he's, you know, a gap from where he should be, or yell at the safety to watch for motion, or communicate all kinds of, you know, on the fly coverage adjustments, that kind of thing before the snap. Obviously, you know, it was kind of interesting to look at his play by play after the game and see just how far downfield he was having to make some of those tackles. It went like 7 yards, 4 yards, 7 yards, 4 yards, mm-hmm. 3 yards, 7 yards. But I attribute a lot of that to just how light the Ravens boxes were, not really to any of his fault. There were, you know, a couple plays where, you know, maybe he should have been quicker to a certain spot, and, you know, a 4 yard gain turns into a 7 yard gain instead of a 5 yard gain, just because of how the running back is kind of able to run through him. But I thought he was productive in all the ways that you expect a guy playing that role to be. He was a violent tackler, which I think is going to be a very important part of this Ravens defense. I mean, you think just back to last year, not just how effective the Ravens were, but how injurious they were, if I'm using that the right way, like the amount of quarterbacks that they just straight up knocked out of games by kicking their ass, but it was something that I think can't be discounted in terms of like what made that defense so special. And then there were also just plays in coverage that stood out to me. There was a second and 10 in the second quarter where he's lined up over the slot. The ball snapped. He collisions the slot receiver to knock him off his route pretty effectively. And then I think even more impressive than that, he kind of positions himself as he goes into his zone drop, where he kind of is backing up like he's boxing a center out in basketball, and is able to position himself away where he also gets in the route of the crosser who's coming in behind that slot receiver and gets in his way as well. So a really nice 2-for-1 deal on that rep. And I think that just goes to show, how smart a player he can be. It's to have that understanding of like, I have to do this, and then I have to do this. And if I get in the way of, the number one receiver, then we'll be even more secure in pass coverage. So, I know John Harbaugh said after the game that he was impressed by Trenton, but that Trenton probably wasn't too impressed by his own performance. And I think obviously if he were impressed by his own performance, he probably would have been the first or second star for last night's game. But still, I think the early returns for Trenton Simpson are definitely really good.
It's a good point. And in a way, I kind of wish I'd been grading his play in a more granular level that I would for other players. But since he's a starter, he's not in any jeopardy. I was more surprised the Ravens left him on the field for as long as they did. The other thing we've seen in camp that I would say is the defining characteristic of Trenton Simpson's play is he's consistently violent. I mean, the guy is way more physical than anybody else on the field. There's a whole bunch of things you're not supposed to do when you're playing against your own teammates and take care of them. You're not supposed to push them down from behind. That's a big one. He's done that. You're not supposed to tackle him in a non-tackling practice, which is even when you're in pads, you don't really tackle. But he does that. He's been much more violent than other players. And as much as they've talked to players like Owe, who've been a very productive pass rusher, day after day, and they don't want him to cause car crashes by pushing offensive linemen back into piles and getting backs of legs mixed up. I mean, somebody should be having a talk with Trenton Simpson about his level of violence on the field. The other guy who matches up with him, Christian Matthew in the defensive backfield, has been a guy who's been very physical, especially with Tez Walker on several plays. But I wonder in terms of, if you're Adafi Owe, yeah, it probably feels good to get that conversation. Hey, take it easy on the offense. You don't want to, get these people all tangled up in their feet and whatnot and cause an injury that's going to ruin our season. He probably feels good about getting that. I don't know how he'd feel about being told to be less violent on the field.
Kent, were you there for the practice? I guess it would have been like 2 weeks ago at this point where Derrick Henry has the inside run and almost gets like clotheslined by a defender.
By Simpson,
That. So did you have it as Simpson? Because I
had it as Simpson, yes. Was it somebody else?
I don't know, because like half of the reports said it was Simpson. Half the reports said it was Travis Jones. And I think my first instinct was Travis Jones, because like I think it's easier to accidentally clothesline a guy if you're getting blocked by offensive lineman. But then when we asked, like when we got Trenton up at the podium, I think, I asked him about it and maybe he didn't know what I was talking about. And he said, and I'm looking at it right now, I have to go back and look at it, but we're just trying to take care of everybody. I don't think it was a clothesline, but yes, just trying to take care of him. And I said, but you were the guy who might've been, I was close to it, but yes. So we didn't really have any closure over the mystery of who clotheslined Derrick Henry. But the fact that someone was able to clothesline Derrick Henry was I think a feat in itself.
I'll tell you what, I'll have my book with me tomorrow at camp and we'll talk through it. But I'm sure we can find the day if you've got the date of the interview and we can find that. But it was definitely a double starred note in my book when it occurred.
Yeah, right. I think at this point it's the Zapruder film. I don't know if any more staring at it will get us any closer to the truth.
All right. Fair enough. It'll be the Mulholland Drive, right? Anyway, let's continue on. That was your number three guy was Trenton Simpson. So my number three guy, I've already talked a fair amount about, is Josh Tapu. Josh Tapu. I always do that wrong. By the way, if you think you've heard Josh Tapu's name before, he is the highlight of his career, and he has only had about 350, 360 total NFL snaps in 6 years so far, all with Cincinnati, was an open field tackle of Lamar Jackson, who put a juke on him. And I think he just guessed in terms of where he was going, made the tackle, and you could tell he was excited. And Lamar actually, you know, patted him on the fanny as he got up on that one.
That's great. I'm looking. So do we know for sure the pronunciation? Because I'm always a sucker for that kind of stuff.
I did actually see it, and it was, I think it was Tapu, but it's on the NFL OMG site. Has a pronunciation group and has it there.
Yeah, yeah. There's a PDF of a Super Bowl flip card from 2022 when the Bengals were against the Rams, and he was on that Bengals roster. And according to the PDF, it's all caps is two TEW and then PO
Tupo, so, as opposed to Tupo. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, very good. Well, I will confirm that against what we've got here from the Ravens. So hopefully it's the same. There's certain players who just seem to be okay with it after a certain amount of time that people mispronounce the name. And the big one on the Ravens to me is Patrick McCary. And he's told people it's McCary. It's McCary. And then, people don't call him McCary till the cows come home, including, a lot of people in the local media. And it just at some point you just give up on people pronouncing your own name correctly.
Well, the probably the most famous example, being a former Raven with Tyrod Taylor, who, it was revealed Tyrod. Like 4 or 5 years ago where it was Tyrod. And then people asked if they were wrong to have called him Tyrod. He said he didn't really care.
Yeah, that's a good one. Okay. Number two for you.
My number two, Ardarius Washington. We talked about him a good bit in that first podcast, but I guess rather than kind of rehash all the good stuff that he did, Ken, if you were to kind of, put a $1 bet on who gets more snaps in week one, Ardarius or Eddie Jackson, or maybe, who gets more snaps, more snaps is the cleaner version of this. Like, I think I was guilty of assuming that safety battle was kind of wrapped up in terms of how the Ravens would go about replacing Geno Stone after they signed Eddie Jackson. But, again, you kind of run the risk of ignoring the ability of Eddie Jackson when you do these training camp battle trackers. And, is the fact that Ardarius Washington is making plays on the ball a good thing while Eddie Jackson is not? Is that a demerit for Eddie Jackson, or is he in fact just like in the right place at the right times that the quarterback is just totally ignoring his side of the field? And so it has been tough for me to divine exactly how the Ravens might feel about, the way to replace Geno Stone. Is it going to be one player? Is it going to be in the aggregate? Is it going to be, how do they kind of make sense of this, Ardarius Washington, Kyle Hamilton, Eddie Jackson, Frankenstein that they have going on here?
Yeah. All right. Let me say, there's a lot of ways the Ravens can solve their slot corner position. I actually think Ardarius Washington is probably the best bet to be the passing down slot corner for the Ravens for this year. Now, for that to be a significant factor, and you're saying in week one, that changes the betting dynamic here a little bit, because they could get behind the Chiefs. And if that's the case, then it's going to be Kyle Hamilton a lot in the slot. And I think it's more likely it's Eddie Jackson on the back end rather than Ardarius. If you want a slightly better tackler, I probably still give the nod to Eddie Jackson over Ardarius coming from the back end at this point. Eddie Jackson, not a great tackler in his career. Ardarius Washington, smallish for the position, certainly. You would not. You'd go the other way?
No, I was agreeing with you that Eddie Jackson is in fact not a good tackler and has been for quite a long time.
Yeah. So And Ardarius smallish for the position. But anyway, if you're thinking about who could take a lot of snaps, if the Ravens were to get ahead of the Chiefs in that game, and it ends up being a game where Mahomes has to throw the ball a lot, and they're in a lot of obvious passing situations from trailing, then I think you could see Ardarius in that slot passing down role that Mallette had last year, fairly consistently in a game like that with Hamilton back on the back end. Don't know that it will happen for sure, but that's certainly a way that it could play out if that is it. So it's a really interesting wager, by the way, really interesting proposition, and just the kind of thought experiment I like. I'm just not sure I really have a really good answer for you right now.
Yeah, and I think if it were any other team, it would probably be a better barometer of where this roster battle stands, but because you know, Andy Reid is so creative with those screens, and who is better against screens in the NFL than Kyle Hamilton? Nobody because else. The Chiefs have, you know, what one of the best tight ends of the NFL still in Travis Kelce. And gosh, I would feel so much more comfortable with, you know, Kyle Hamilton matching up against Travis Kelce, despite how last year's game went. You know, with all due respect to Ardarius Washington and Eddie Jackson, don't feel great about their chances of bringing down a guy like that, or being able to outsmart him, or, you know, just kind of able to disrupt that mind meld that he has with Patrick Mahomes. So what we see in week one in terms of the distribution of slot snaps and safety snaps could be quite deceiving in terms of what we actually get over the course of the long haul of the season, assuming everyone stays healthy.
Mm-hmm. All right. So he was your number two guy. I had lots of positive under Darius in this game. He was one of my top guys. But he was just an honorable mention in the MVP. My number two guy is Pepe Williams. We've talked about him a little already. Big, important step back into the light for Pepe Williams. He's a guy I don't think was sure of a roster spot at all. Now he's right there competing with other players, possibly with an outside corner. You know, Mallette's injury obviously is a very big deal for him personally in terms of his chance to make the team. Has not gotten on the field all that much during the regular season. And now he's a third-year player, so he's got kind of that millstone around his neck that he's got less sand in the hourglass left for the Ravens to you know, harvest value from. So they could well be looking at a player like it wouldn't be one of the veterans. So Kadar Holman's in a worse position, relatively speaking, but like a Bump Cooper for a practice squad spot would be a better choice for a roster spot. You know, him competing with JAD is a matter of whether you need an outside corner or a slot corner more. To me, Pepe Williams' game here, though, puts him right back in the middle of the discussion for who makes this roster. And with the Ravens' creativity at managing the end of their roster, I think they'll find a way to keep him somehow. Whether it's as a midseason replacement, having somebody else being the midseason replacement, he's on the start of the year. But this is a very big game for him.
Yeah, and a big week for him because he had I think a couple of days earlier he had the interception on, I believe, Devin Leary, where he undercut a route to Malik Cunningham for a red zone interception. I think it was probably more a factor of Devin Leary throwing a bad pass than Pepe Williams being a, you know, having a star caliber play. But you got to make those plays. And I think a good sign for him that he's been able to practice these 3 or so weeks of a training camp with no real wear or tear from the couple ankle operations that he had last year that were so harmful to his, you know, progress as a second year player. So hopefully he stays healthy. I don't have his Pro Football Reference page handy. Did he contribute a lot on special teams as a rookie? I mean, is that something that could be held against him as the Ravens formulate their 53-man roster?
I will look it up as we're going here, but why don't we move on to your number one guy, and I'll look up Pepe Williams on special teams.
Yeah, but my number one is your number one. It's Nate Wiggins. Just he was the best player in the field, I think, for a good bit of that game. You know, obviously, don't want to besmirch the competition too much. It wasn't a great collection of Eagles receivers. I think probably only Johnny Wilson might be guaranteed a spot on the 53 of the guys that he went up against. But he bossed every single one of them. I think probably the PFF had him for two completions allowed. But if they are going, I didn't find a way to make the math right in terms of who those were, because I think it was like two completions for 12 yards, and it wouldn't have been the out route that was a nice throw by, I think, McKee, or maybe it was Pickett that he allowed, and also the touchdown, because that would have been more than 12 yards. So maybe it was just the out route and then the throw in the flat that he came up and, you know, made the nice play on, and then also got hurt on. But that's a good day's work, you know, four incompletions forced, three pass defenses, and a willingness to stick your nose in there in the flat and on run defense. I think it's a really, really splendid day for him, and just in general.
I had him for 8 yards on 6 targets. So he had a 9-yard catch right by the sideline. Good play, contested the catch, just a good catch. What was good about that play is he made that tackle right away too. So he contested the catch. Yeah. He tried to get it loose, but then he made the tackle right away for no yak. And then the play that came out for was a tackle for loss for minus one. So my ledger is balanced in terms of having 8 yards on 6 targets, which is, that's an unbelievable game, by the way. The only thing he's missing is a pick in this game, but otherwise we've had to, if he had an interception among those 8 passes, the quarterback rating against him, if it was just turn one of the incompletes interception, the quarterback rating against him would have been about 3, because it was 42.4 and he got 0 out of the 39 points for the interceptions. So his passer rating would have been fantastic if that happened.
Yeah. And I think he needed a performance not like this, not that he had been struggling in camp, but I feel like, you know, these guys are such athletic freaks that maybe the motor gets a little bit revved down in camp. You know, you see him allow completions to a guy like Keith Kirkwood. You know, Sean Ryan has, I think, kind of out muscled him over the middle once or twice for completions. You know, he has not been getting the kind of reps against the first team that even someone like Jalen Armour Davis has, which, you know, ties back to our discussion about where does he actually stand in the outside cornerback rotation. But you know, if you can trust a guy to show up in the not quite prime time, but under the bright lights of a game like this against a team that he's never seen before and ball out the way that he did, I think you want to put stock in that more than you do in, you know, some performances in practice where you feel like maybe he's kind of sleepwalking through some periods.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, there is just a lot of brother-in-law play, and there are certain periods that are half speed and quarter speed periods during camp where there's expected to be no effort made by the defense. You're basically letting the offense make their install of and learn their dance steps for running particular routes. Some of that is done against the colored jersey equipment manager people in what I call 11 versus colors or 7 versus colors drills. But even in the 11 on 11, particularly towards the end of the day, they often have a no defense kind of a thing. They still want to see that the defenders get to their proper spot in zone coverage, for example, but you don't want to be, you know, physically contesting for the football late in a practice and, you know, God forbid, lose somebody at that point. I do have the information on Damarian Williams here. So in 2022, he played 134 total special team snaps, according to PFF, and he played on 3 teams. He'd have 2 kick return snaps and 1 punt coverage snap, but basically wasn't involved in those units. He had kick coverage for 73 snaps, so he's a major guy on kickoffs. Punt return snaps of 31. I'm sure that's mostly as a jammer. And field goal block snaps of 27. So he'd be an outside gotcha guy on those. But yeah, it's, you know, there's really 5 units, 6 if you include the field goal kicking team, that people can play on that are of linebacker or, you know, defensive back size. And the more you can play on them, the better. And if you're Malik Harrison, you play on every single one. And if you're otherwise shaped, you play on what ones that your body type actually fits for.
Yeah. Don't want to make this a dynamic kickoff podcast segment, but it was interesting to me just kind of scrubbing through some of the film today that I think both the Ravens and the Eagles had the same technique point on the kickoff returns, where they had a double team basically right up the middle on, like, I guess if you want to call it the A gap of the dynamic kickoff. That was the teaching point that both the Ravens and the Eagles had. And I think it kind of worked, because I believe both the one successful Ravens kickoff and the one successful Eagles kickoff both came right down the pike there. So obviously it was interesting to me that they forewent, or that they didn't just do one-on-one blocking across the board, but they forewent some of those matchups just to actually look for double teams. And I don't think we'll be seeing Pepe Williams as the guy in the middle of that particular maelstrom anytime soon, because you want bigger, stronger bodies in the middle of those kickoffs. But it was you know, kind of curious and interesting to me that even though I'm sure both the Ravens and the Eagles were holding their cards back a little bit, not showing their cards much, that the techniques or the fundamentals on some of those returns were pretty much identical in terms of like what you want to emphasize or what you want to see up the middle.
We got to get out of here, but I want to just tell one little story before this. Harbaugh, after the game, asked about how the offensive line performed. Well, you know, overall, it seemed like pass blocking was good, but I really need to look at the tape. To me, a guy who watches a lot of offensive line play, you need to do that. You need to build it within the framework. I never feel comfortable giving my opinions on offensive line without looking at the tape on a how did I feel about that offensive line play. It's too easy to get whipsawed. But with Harbaugh talking about the kickoff, he goes, somebody asked him, might have been you, Jonas, about what was that long return, the one long return that the Eagles had. And he goes, oh, geez, yeah, our L3 guy didn't squeeze in on that. You can tell, you know, Harbaugh's coming from a special teams background. He sees that play like it's like he's watching the All-22 probably from his sideline position. He's so good at that.
Watching that play live and then also the All-22, I think the Eagles got away with a slight push in the back. I forget exactly who got pushed. It was, you know, one of those plays where it happens in a blink and you're not sure whether the guy is getting pushed on the side or pushed in the back. But to me, there was the slightest of pushes in the back, and that kind of opened up the gap that led to the Eagles bringing that out to the 36 yard line or wherever it happened. So, maybe, you know, the referees are in preseason form too. And in a regular season game where the NFL has their best crews out there, then that is a play that's coming back to the 15-yard line. But to me, if I'm John Harbaugh, I'm not feeling as bad about that play as perhaps I would have, you know, watching it from a kind of obscured spot along the sideline.
All right. Jonas, always great talking football with you. Look forward to seeing you again at camp tomorrow and for the rest of the week at least. Tell folks where they can talk football with you online or read your work.
Yeah, thebaltimorebanner.com. Subscription ranges, I believe, is $1 for 6 months. So that will take you through the course of the season. And you can follow me on Twitter at Jonas_Schaefer and send me an email if you need to at jonas.schaefer@thebaltimorebanner.com.
All right. Jonas, one of the really fun people to watch practice with, and he's the most reliable guy I'm aware of to fill in any holes I have in my book of plays. So if you can always ask Jonas, is like to say, who was the coverage on that player? You know, and one thing about Jonas, if you haven't ever met him in person, he's a very tall guy. We don't always talk about this. And I know he doesn't like to be teased about too much, but 6'5", 6'6", I'm guessing, right, Jonas? Roughly?
Yep, 6'6".
Okay. And he never has that problem of being on the sidelines and having people in their way to the same degree that people who are a little shorter, and there are a fair number of those in the Ravens media. Anyway, I'm very bothered by sight lines. I try and get a hill because I was one of very very specific and needy about my sight line, and Jonas is in that nice position where he always almost captures what goes on in a play.
Yeah, other folks, it's a blessing and a curse. Because the Ravens' new press box, where I don't know how much grousing you'll see on Twitter this year about it again, but you know, the Ravens obviously with their stadium renovations kicked us out of the long standing place of the press, mm-hmm. press box, which was, you know, basically center view. That is now the location of the fancy new Blackwing Suites. We're a little bit to the right of that now. And the sight lines
in the corner.
Press box are, we got kicked to the corner, and the sight lines for the press box are not great, especially if you're not on the first row. But as part of the new redesign, there are, you know, TVs now in spots that weren't there at the old press box. And I think twice or three times during the course of Friday night's game, I stood up from my seat on the press box and hit my head on one of the corners of the TV. So I think that's going to be something that I'm going to deal with as an occupational hazard. And obviously it's something that no one else in that press box besides maybe Chad Steele, the Ravens PR chief and a former D1 basketball player, really has to worry about.
That is a good story, and frankly, that is prime real estate that the press box was taking up before. It made all kinds of sense for the Ravens to revenueize that, to monetize yes. that spot, which I know is unfortunate. The one I was concerned about is these additional seats on the field that they put. I thought that was going to create effectively wave of people standing up. But very fortunately, they didn't put them on behind the benches, so there's none in front of my section, so it doesn't create that problem. We still have occasional problems with people, basically in the aisles who are getting excited, moving around and kind of blocking the sight lines. But I'll tell you, it's a far cry from being in the corner, and I'm sorry in a relative sense for the folks who got their press box position marginalized by this. I hope there's nobody who got truly marginalized in a corner where you have a piece of the field blocked off. Is there anybody who's in that position?
I think those seats will probably be going to visiting media the less prestigious visiting media. I think I believe Jerry Sandusky, obviously the legendary voice of the Ravens, was not too keen on getting a new spot for his radio perch. I believe the only person, the only booth for the Ravens media that was not moved around was the national TV booth, because obviously you're not going to mess with that prize position. So, when the Tony Romos of the world come through, they are still going to be calling the game from the exact same spot as they were before. But to your point, Ken, about the field level seats, I was sitting next to Jeff Rebecca and Jameson Hensley at Friday's game. And I think it was Jeff who got a text from someone who was sitting on those field level seats, and the sight lines were not great. I mean,
of course not.
Obviously, if
you're they're right on field level.
Regular person, if you're a regular person trying to watch a game behind a group of guys who are between 6 foot and 6 foot six, you're probably better off, in the club level watching the game on TV. So, I guess buyer beware if you have that kind of cash to splash around, because it did not look like a particularly appealing place to watch a game from.
I mean, we've known that for years. The front rows of the stadium are not nearly as good as the first raised row. Row 19 of the lower deck. That's where the great seats begin. They've now changed their pricing mechanism so that the seats closer to the field are actually more expensive. And I figured out why they had to do it. They had to do it because they were selling these new on-field seats. And they had to pretend like those seats were great. So they charge a ton for those. They just charge the highest other price is right behind you here. But they had to do that right, where they would have been giving away the notion that those seats were really not that fantastic. Anyway, is what it is. We've talked enough about that particular topic. I'll just say, folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, hit me up. DMs are always open on Twitter. If you could do the show a favor, you've listened for over 2 hours to Jonas and me go through a lot of minutiae about that first Eagles game without even talking about the stupidity of running an offensive play with 16 seconds to go. It would be nice if you could write a short review to drive additional traffic to the website or to the YouTube or whatever it might be. Really appreciate that. And it's a small non-monetary way you can help the show. Jonas, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, Ken, for having me.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.